Hello everyone, and welcome to the Council of Elrond, where we discuss all things Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, and general Tolkien lore. On today's episode, we are going to ask ourselves the question, why do the elves and dwarves hate each other? Now, before we kick off today's episode, I'd like to thank all the people that continue to sign up to our Patreon account, and to all the new subscribers that are finding our YouTube page. So if you haven't already, please head on over and watch us on YouTube as we explore that new territory, and give us a like and a subscribe if you can. You can find all our links in the podcast info section. Now, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
All right, so actually, before we get into it, how are you, John? Any news? What's the crack? Are you enjoying season two?
I am. I'm loving season two. Well, in terms of any news, not much, but in terms of Lord of the Rings news, I've just started watching the 4K versions of the movies. So
nice.
I got you and I both got the DVDs, the 4K versions this Christmas, and I haven't been able to watch them until now because I didn't have a 4K player. So I finally got around to getting myself a 4K player, and I didn't want to watch them on like a different type of a DVD player, which didn't have the utmost crispness. So I was waiting for that. So I got myself a 4K player, and now I'm. I've just watched the Two Towers last night, and yeah, my God.
Jeez, you're quick.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good, yeah?
Yeah, well, I watched The Fellowship at the weekend, and then last night watched Two Towers, and yeah, just that kind of thing. When you watch it in 4K, there's just loads of little details that you kind of maybe missed out on before, or just little things in the background that you can see more clearly. I'm just noticing way more like the landscapes and just mountains everywhere. Like,
yeah.
Mountains, Gandalf. So that's what Bilbo was talking about when he wanted to see the mountains. He wanted to see them in 4K.
He was talking about the 4K. Yeah. 4K version.
I want to see mountains in 4K, Gandalf. Mountains.
4K, Gandalf.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it could be worth doing a review on those whenever
Possibly.
I get a 4K player.
Yeah.
Again, I have the TV. In fact, I don't even think my TV is 4K.
Yeah, I bought a 4K.
No, I do have a 4K player. I have the PlayStation 5, which is 4K.
Okay.
Player, I think. Yeah. I just don't have the TV.
I bought the 4K TV, and then I was like, "Wait, I have a PlayStation 4." And I was like, "That's not going to cut it." So I had to splurge on the old 4K player as well. That's how they get you.
All right. Well, if people out there, if they want a review on the 4K. Versions of Lord of the Rings, let us know. And
I can do that. David, Dave can't do that yet.
Well, I could just go over to your house and
you
can see how
you
it
can.
Is.
That's for sure.
For anyone that's watching and they might see my lovely red complexion, we got some sun in Ireland this weekend and I got extremely burnt. I didn't tell you, I went to Cork. So shout out to Cork.
Lovely.
And it's beautiful sunny weather.
Is it sunnier down in Cork?
I think so. It was really, really hot. And then I came back to Galway and everyone was like, yeah, it was nice, but it was a bit windy and, you know, I didn't want to go outside. It was a bit cold. And I was walking around
even,
in a t-shirt and I was boiling.
That's even better, isn't it? Don't you love when you go away somewhere and the weather is beautiful and you go home and you realize that the weather was like crap. It's even better when it's like, oh, it's raining back at home. You're like, yes.
Yeah. No, like I think the temperatures were quite high, but it was, I don't know, it wasn't as blue skies and beautiful as it was in Cork, but Cork was lovely. Yeah, really enjoyed it, and it's like my first proper time in Cork, so yeah, shout out to Cork.
Nice city.
Yeah, lovely city. So yeah, let's get into this question. Why do the elves and dwarves hate each other? And yeah, I know you said before the podcast that you didn't want us me to straight up ask you, but do you know the answer to this, or do you want to just like
I didn't say I didn't want because basically for if people don't know how we kind of organize our podcasts, generally one of us takes charge of a podcast each week, and so for example when we just logged on today and we said okay let's start recording, I had to ask Dave what this podcast was even going to be about. So the amount of preparation that I have done is zero, and Dave has done all the preparations this week, and then we kind of mix.
Oh, I didn't do any preparation. Did you not do any preparation? Yeah. But like, I do think that's, especially with season two, or a lot of season one as well, when we started off, we were like, right, we need to know, what are you going to ask me? What am I going to ask you? Now it's kind of like 5 seconds before we click record. It's like, whoa, what are we doing?
Yeah, but I think this episode about? I think it's better that it's more way natural, because you kind of get like an actual natural reaction to these types of questions. So folks, you're going to see a lot more of like, I actually have no idea to these kinds of questions. But
I still answered a lot of season one questions the same way. I was like, I don't know that one.
Yeah, I researched this yesterday and now I've forgotten.
Anyways, if you are just a fan of the Lord of the Rings films, you would probably have picked up on the rivalry between elves and dwarves at the Council of Elrond scene, or that meeting, where Gimli yells at Legolas saying things like, "And I suppose you think you're the one to do it." And I'll be dead before...
Never trust an elf.
Exactly, I was going to say. No one trusts an elf, and I'll be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf. Which, by the way, that line, anyways, isn't said in the book. And as a matter of fact, Gimli is quite quiet during the meeting while his father, Gloin, does most of the talking. But anyways, that's
quite cool.
Neither here nor there. But Peter Jackson does a great job showing the viewer that the elves and dwarves generally do not get on with each other, but Legolas and Gimli eventually overcome their obstacles and form a strong relationship.
Oh, I just had the opinion that Gimli was like just a standalone racist dwarf, the only one in the group that was like, he really hates the elves, but all the rest of the dwarves were like, oh, they're fine.
No, he's the representative of for a dwarf. and you do kind of feel like Gimli's probably the more racist one, where Legolas says things and Gimli shouts at him and Legolas just doesn't really retaliate and just kind of goes, okay,
When you see that thing of Gimli shouting at Legolas, like not really responding at all, and he doesn't really say any negative things towards dwarves, you kind of get the feeling that maybe the elves were in the wrong and that they knew, we probably deserve this. So
yeah, but there are a couple of snide remarks. Like I can remember when someone says something about like, what did they say when they come into Moria, and someone says something like, oh, the dwarves forgot about this, and then Legolas is like,
why does that not surprise me?
Yeah. And then Gimli's like,
And Haldir as well. He's like,
oh, Haldir's a bird.
Breathes so loudly, we could have shot him in the dark. That's a nice little dig as well. I love the little
Peter Jackson, like, he does a good job conveying this thing, but we don't really know why they dislike each other. But then again, if we're just looking at, or if we're just talking about people that watch the movies and haven't read any of the Tolkien material, and then we see the Hobbit movies, we see the origin, as it were, of the dwarves' distrust in the elves and vice versa. So do you recall any of these scenes from, what's the first one? An Unexpected Adventure? Is that what it's called?
Expected Journey?
Journey, yeah. I'm going on a journey. Adventure? It was getting mixed up.
So I think in the Hobbit movies, it's been a while since I've seen them, but I think in those movies, they show the battles. There's a few battles from back in the day where all the dwarves were being attacked by the orcs, and basically the elves kind of refused to help. And I think they show the where like Thorin's father gets killed, and that's where he gets the name Thorin Oakenshield, because he has to like pick up this big branch from an oak tree and use it as a shield when he's fighting against Azog in the movie. Is it Azog or is it fighting against Bolg in the book? I can't really remember.
That's a good question. It's definitely Azog in the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's Azog in the book as well.
Yeah. I can't remember, because I know that Azog...
Bolg is there, I think.
But Bolg is Azog's son.
Son, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure there's lots of parts where in the Hobbit movies they show them together where they couldn't have possibly been together because Azog had died a long time before. I think Azog died 150 years before. Hang on, I'm gonna mess this up. So better just continue on and you tell me what.
Cut that.
No, because I know that there was a battle. We spoke about this recently in our orc episode. Just like we were looking at the question of how long orcs live, and we were saying that there's a battle that Bolg featured in 150 years after Azog had died. So we knew that he had to be at least that old. He couldn't have been, like, I mean, you know, he had to be at least 151, I suppose. So yeah, that was the minimum age he could have been. So yeah,
had a baby at one. Just let everyone know, a little warning in case anyone hears any background noise on my end. I have builders in the house and they might be making some noise. So I'm sorry if you hear a loud drilling in the background. So yeah, moving on. So it was when the dwarven city of Erebor was being ransacked by Smaug that Thranduil appears on the hilltop. That scene where he has this huge armed force of elven warriors, but they just like refuse to help Thorin. And then in the Desolation of Smaug, Thranduil explains to Thorin that he warned his grandfather of the greed what his greed would summon, basically, but he wouldn't listen. So I think when I was watching the Hobbit movies, I was kind of thinking, oh, this is kind of where the distaste between elves and dwarves came from, because I don't know, I hadn't read the books at that point, or couldn't remember. I definitely hadn't read the Lord of the Rings books or the Silmarillion. But this turning away on the hilltop does not happen in the book at all. And Thranduil actually appears as a kind and wise character, and the only reason he imprisons the dwarves is because his knowledge of the dwarves' greed and the fact that they were trespassing and refused to explain their intentions. So he's not really a bad guy.
No, sounds kind of dwarvish, all right? What are you doing here? None of your business. But you're in my house. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And like, he could have just thought that they were coming to rob him because, you know, they weren't explaining what was going on. They knew they were greedy, greedy creatures and they're always looking for shiny objects. But I think it was also the fact that it's important to know that it's not just an elf capturing a dwarf. It's the elven king capturing a dwarven king. And like, that was also a big middle finger to the dwarves. And yeah, I don't know. But yeah, if we're looking at the actual origin of the dwarves and the elves' distrust from each other, it stems from lots of events in their history. But one that people view as the most damaging to their relationship would occur in the year 502 of the First Age, which is approximately 6,700 years before the events of the Lord of the Rings. So I have a little story here.
Okay.
So get ready. Dwarves and elves worked and traded together civilly, and dwarves would often help elves when it came to building and smithing, including helping to build the Menegroth, or also known as the Thousand Caves, which was a city in the realm of Doriath, which was one of the most powerful elven realms in the First Age. So Doriath was ruled by King Thingol, who shows up in, you've heard of him in The Children of Húrin and The Silmarillion, and Beren and Lúthien as well. So we hear a lot about this King Thingol character in the older stories.
Thingol and Melian. Yeah.
Melian, yeah, very good. So we know that in Tolkien's lore, jewels and jewelry are very important, obviously Lord of the Rings, and especially to royalty. And King Thingol came into possession of two immense pieces of craftsmanship. So the first
was a thimble. Was the
Thingol has a thimble.
Thingol has a thimble
on his thumb. No, it wasn't a thimble. It was called the Noglamir, or the Necklace of the Dwarves, which was combined with the craft of the dwarves and gems from Valinor. It was of great beauty, and it gave beauty to its wearer. And despite it being loaded with gems, it sat very lightly on the neck. So that was the first piece of craftsmanship that Thingol.
Well.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I was going to just straight up say it, but could you guess what the other gem was that Thingol had in his possession?
Is it a gem or is it a? It's not like
it's a famous one.
Okay, it's not like the helm or anything.
No, it's a gem.
Like he didn't have a Silmaril.
Yes,
he did.
He did. So that managed to come into his possession. It was one of the three Silmarils created by whom?
Created by, I'm going blank. I just can't think of it. Give me a first letter.
F.
Alfeanor.
Yeah. Well done. All
right. My God. Cool.
Sorry. I know that one. It's so, one that's obvious, but it would throw you. It would throw you. So
it's too many Feanor, F names.
There's too many. But for anyone that doesn't know, Feanor is one of the greatest elf smiths, and probably one of the greatest smiths ever. Mm-hmm. And And if you don't know what the Silmarils are, they were three gems known as the Silmarils, and they play an extremely important role in the events of the First Age, which you can read about in the books such as the Silmarillion and Beren and Lúthien. But anyways, moving on, King Thingol wanted to combine both the Nauglamir and the Silmaril to form the most beautiful piece of craftsmanship in Middle-earth. But this was no easy task, so he entrusted the dwarves from the city Nogrod, that happened to just be in Thingol's city of Menegroth at the time. He just like saw them there and was like, hey, you guys, come help me with my smithy work. So they agreed, but this did take a long time, and King Thingol was very impatient, and he often visited the smithies to check up on the progress. But sure enough, when it was completed, it was beautiful. The light of the Silmaril actually reflected amongst the gems, and it truly was the perfect piece of work, and anyone that looked upon it was entranced. However, the dwarves, they had grown greedy, of course, and when they finished their work, they refused to hand it to Thingol. They argued that the Nauglamir was, in fact, a dwarven artifact, which they're right, that the dwarves actually created this Nauglamir. It was gifted to Finrod, who was an elf, but Finrod was dead at this point, and they claimed that Thingol had no claim to it, so it belonged to the dwarves. Naturally, Thingol reacted very angrily and insulted them, as we read in the Silmarillion, quote, bade them with shameful words be gone unrequited out of Doriath. He called the dwarves stunted people, and this angered them, so they killed the king and fled the city.
Oh, wow.
The elves then chased down the dwarves and retrieved the Nauglamir and killed the dwarves in the process, but two managed to escape and return to their city of Nogrod, where they told their kin that the elves betrayed them and were ordered to kill the dwarves by the king, as he wanted to cheat them out of their payment. So naturally, this stirred up anger and vengeance within the dwarves in the city of Nogrod. Wow. So they then raised an army and marched back to Menegroth and battled with the elves victoriously, and then completely sacked the city. So it was a...
So the dwarves were victorious?
The dwarves... Yeah, basically, dwarves were there killing Thingol, then tried to run away. Elves caught up to them, killed the dwarves and stole the jewellery, the Nauglamir, got back to the city, but two escaped, and they went back to Nogrod and just... They were basically like, King Thingol sent out his elves and killed us all, and they just didn't want us to pay for... Or, you know, they didn't want
give
to pay.
Get some
and
fake then, news.
Yeah, fake news. And then the dwarves that came up, this huge army, went back to Menegroth and completely destroyed the place.
Wow.
So
don't that was mess with the dwarves.
Or the elves. Like, they're just mental back then.
Yes.
But
Silmarillion's mental.
The Silmarillion, it's crazy. If you think the elves are like beautiful creatures that only care about peace and stuff, then go read the Silmarillion.
But in the third age, they were a bit more chill. First age was madness.
I suppose they've evened out, or they've become a little bit more mature in the third age.
Exactly.
That didn't like cause an all-out war between the races. Like the bloodshed actually ended there, but there was a clear split divide between the two races. And they may not have been at war after that straight away, but there was forever distrust and animosity.
Yeah, because they used to be good mates before, like when... we know that, for example, the doors of Moria, they were built built by the elves, because the elves used to live outside that part of Moria, and then they used to pass through Moria to do their trading business and all that. And there was lots of friendship and trade between the elves and the dwarves back in the day. So, obviously that must have caused a huge immediate change to that relationship. And as you said, they didn't have to go to war immediately, but it was a big shift.
Well, I think, I don't know the exact dates. I know this was 502 of the First Age, but I don't know when the Doors of Durin were created. But it is important to note that it's mostly the Sindar elves and grey elves that kind of held on to this animosity with the dwarves. Mm. And then pretty much all the dwarves were always kind of angry with elves. But there were sections, so you're right. There was the elves of Eregion and the dwarves of Khazad Dûm. I think this was after this feud. They still managed to work together, and they had trade. And there were, like, it's not every single dwarf and elf hated each other, but there are examples of like
That's cool.
You know, stories where they got on. But yeah, the elves in general would never forget what had happened to their ancient elven realm and the murder of their king. And whilst the dwarves would forever blame the elves, and they didn't know how they were lied to. So it was kind of the fault of those two random guys that got away, in my opinion.
Yeah,
those guys that just lied to the dwarves, and like that's what the dwarves built their trust and hatred on elves.
I can see the dwarves, like you know, saying that they have a claim to that necklace piece. But yeah. I think it's a bit ridiculous if like the king comes and gives them the necklace and the Silmarillion, and he's like, I want you to join these two together, and they don't say anything about it. Then they're like, we will do that. And then later they're like, okay, now they're joined together. This part's ours, so it's all ours. It's like
I think
it's a bit of a sneaky move by the dwarves.
Yeah. I didn't put in any other quotes, but I think when the dwarves, or when Thingol gave tasked them with this mission, the dwarves were immediately like overcome with lust, but they were like, okay, we'll accept it. But I think it wasn't, like I said, they grew greedy, but I think they were like, right, we all love this piece straight away. And naturally, if they're spending like weeks and months working with it, they're like, what are we doing this for? Let's just take it.
Yeah.
Take it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that story shows how greed, lies, and lust over gems really split apart these two races. And for generations afterwards, the dwarves believed their version of the events and the elves believed their own. So again, it's kind of like modern day fake news, where you're just going to believe what you were taught when you were a child. And it was passed down through generation through generation. Mm. And I suppose it lived on in the memory.
Very good. That's interesting. I'd forgotten most of that.
All of it. That's how the Silmarillion works. You read one chapter and you forget the previous one. So,
well, like that's it. Like even just like names of characters. Like there was, you know, there's a time when you're in the middle of reading the Silmarillion and you're kind of going like, oh, Feanor is one of the most important characters. He's basically, you know. When you're in the middle of reading it, you feel like, oh, I know this character as well as I know Aragorn. And then you're like, who was it? What was his name? I was like, I can't even remember his name right now. So it's just like when you're not constant. For me, I've got a bad memory anyway. But like when I go any length of time without having read any of the books, or, you know, could be any of the back catalog as well of whichever stories, there'll be bits and pieces that you remember, but it'll be more difficult to remember the names of the characters and things like that. So you have to kind of constantly just keep on top of it and try and keep on remembering the names of everyone and all the family tree and stuff. So, but I mean, I'm very happy to keep going back to it and reading the books again and again. So it's great.
Yeah, I think that's another thing as well. When you're introduced to a new character, or you could be introduced to like 10 on one page, like 10 new characters. And I always forget, like, is this lad an elf or is he a man? Or what is he? This guy a dwarf, you know? And sometimes the hint is in the name, like, you know, you're not going to have like an Oin or a Gloin that are elves.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, even I remember before I had read any of the books at all, and I'd just heard of the story of Beren and Luthien, I was like, which one of them is the man, which one is the woman, and who's the elf?
I was just about to say that. And I always used to make the mistake thinking that Beren was the woman.
Yeah.
I was just like the elf maiden. And but I was like, the female was Beren and Luthien was the man. And I was just like, I used to make the mistake all the time.
Yeah, but, me too. Yeah. Mm. I thought Beren was the dog and Huon was the woman.
Huon?
I will be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf.
So yeah, even if we look back to the very first encounter between dwarves and elves, so this is way, way back, it wasn't the smoothest of meetings. So before each race even knew each other existed, again, way, way back, I don't have the date, but somewhere back there, there was this subgroup of dwarves, back in early March, maybe late February, there was a subgroup of dwarves that weren't really liked by other dwarves because of possibly the way they were shorter or less sociable, or perhaps because they didn't hide their secret language from others. They used their Khuzdul names, which is kind of a no-no in dwarven culture. Or perhaps they didn't really care for the caving underground to live in, which is why they established the land of Beleriand as their home. So you was might recognize...
Yeah, was this the group that was like seven dwarven like families and like there was, you know, the number seven is very famous with the, well, with lots of things, but with the dwarves especially. Mm-hmm. There were the seven dwarven kings, seven like kingdoms and areas and like families and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if you ask people how many like groups of dwarves were there, often people would say seven, but there was actually an eighth, which was made up of kind of like all the rejects that were kicked out.
Yeah.
Is that the group that you're talking about?
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I didn't know that there was an official eighth group, but do you remember what they were called?
Oh, I don't know. It was something like
there's a character,
the crap dwarves. Like,
well, it's not fair. It's a,
yeah. It's, I remember it being something similar to that. Like, just like basically the title.
Do you remember? Do you remember the character Meme from the Children of Húrin?
Oh, M-I-M. Yeah. Sorry, Meme. I used to always call him Mim.
Mim. What was he? He wasn't pretty. He was
ugly.
The petty dwarves.
Ah, he was petty.
Petty, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I knew it was something like, you know, some like derogatory term, yeah, that you use like against him. Like, yeah.
Definitely. Well, when I first read that in The Children of Húrin, like one of the petty dwarves, I just thought like, oh, that's just Tolkien using some funny language to describe a perfectly normal dwarf. But yeah, they actually were a subgroup of dwarves that were looked down upon even more so than a regular dwarf.
Yeah, just like, yeah. What type of dwarf are you? It's like, I was going to use a pejorative term to describe my entire group of people and be like, we're all very petty. Yeah.
So anyways, these dwarves, they didn't really care much about living underground, and they actually decided to live in this land of Beleriand. When the elves arrived to Beleriand and saw these creatures, they didn't realize that these dwarves were people, and so they hunted them and slaughtered them like animals. It was pretty much like an ethnic cleansing, and it was bad and it was messy, and
but they're not people. We can kill these, right?
It's pretty racist. But like, the petty dwarves, they only kind of came out at night, and they were really sneaky, and they would like sneak around. So like, and they didn't really talk much or something like that.
The elves thought they were like raccoons.
I don't know. Yeah, raccoons or squirrels or big massive rats or something. But they honestly just like thought of them as animals. And remember, elves, tall, slender and beautiful, they'd never seen creatures like this before, so they're like, oh, what is that? And they're all, you know, hairy and gross. So it wasn't until the elves actually met true dwarves that they realized that this subgroup that they had been killing,
and they were like, oh god, don't tell anyone.
They're like, stall the ball.
Yeah.
So that they just realized this must be their kin. So and it was the elves that actually coined the name petty dwarves for these subgroup of dwarves. And even though these petty dwarves were despised by regular dwarves, they were still acknowledged as kin, and their slaughters were remembered. So that was like another thing that kind of, you know, like this happened at the very beginning. It just wasn't a good, you know, first impressions are very important. And if your first impression is being slaughtered by the other person, then...
Yeah, it's like the dwarves not good. Like found some old tweets by the elves, and they were like, you said this back in 2011. And they're like, oh, God.
But we've moved on. Society has moved on. We were allowed to kill you guys back then.
That was your opinion then. So
yeah,
we'll kill you for it.
I was going to ask you as well to think of an example of how dwarves and elves worked well together. But yeah, you were perfectly right when you spoke of the Dwarves of Durin, and how in the film... I think we might have asked each other this question in like one of our very first podcasts, where we were like, why is that ancient dwarven door written in Elvish? Or the password is spoken in Elvish? And that is the answer, because it was built by both dwarves and elves, and for the trading of both races. So
yeah. It was built by them both, but the enchantment was put on it by the elves.
That's pretty cool. And it's pretty niche. It's like,
they're like, we have built this together as friends.
Yeah, and they held hands and chanted together.
There was a little sing song.
If we want to actually dig a little deeper into why dwarves and elves seem to naturally hate each other.
My God, I do.
Do you? Oh, this may have been something rooted deeper in their beings from their creation. So, Johnny, in our Moria episode, you discussed how the dwarves were created. Can you recall much at all? Or can you give me a quick refresher on how they were created or by whom?
So the dwarves were created by Orome. Is that correct?
No.
Which feckin' Valor corrected them? created them. Not Orome? Who was it? No, Orome is the hunter.
Yeah.
Who the hell is the smith? God, give me another first edition, first letter.
A.
A.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm going blank again.
But it's a weird one to pronounce. It's a,
I can't remember.
Aule.
Aule. Ah, of course. Yeah. Orome and Aule. I often mix them lads up. Anyway. Yeah. Aule was the smith, and he was a Vala. So we know that he was like, you know, just one tier below the main god. So he was really powerful. And he created these dwarves. And basically, he gave them life before the main god, Iluvatar, had created his children of Iluvatar, which were going to be the elves. And he did this, like he wasn't trying to jump the gun, but he kind of did accidentally. And he was going to then he made like seven of the seven leaders of the households of the dwarves. And then Iluvatar got mad at him for making them before he had had the chance to make his own children, the elves. And so Aule was like going to slaughter them guys. But then Iluvatar was like, look, relax, it's okay. They can live, but you have to put them to sleep. And it wasn't like a euphemism for, you know, send them away to live on a farm.
Euthanasia.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like actually put them to sleep for like a long, long time, for hundreds of years. Yeah. So
let it happen.
So they went to sleep for a long time anyway. And then Iluvatar made the elves. And then after the elves had been like, you know, the first children to grace Middle Earth, then he was allowed to let the dwarves wake up. And so they all kind of, we hear about during the first awakening, like alone and all, he just kind of wakes up and he's there in the nip, just like, oh, what's going on here? I just wandered around. And he's like, Jesus,
I've had many mornings like that.
Yeah. Where am I?
Why am I naked? What is that bear doing in my bed?
So that's how they came to be.
Yes. Yeah. Perfect. Absolutely nailed it. So if people don't know who the god of Middle Earth is, it is this Eru Iluvatar, and that was supposed to be the supreme god that could create true life. And like Johnny so eloquently put it, Aule the Smith. It's funny when I say Aule the Smith, I just think of like Will Smith, or, you know, like that's how they named each other. It's like Will the Smith, Aule the Smith. But anyways, Aule wasn't slapping his dwarves, but he was the one that like gave these dwarves life, but it wasn't like true life. I think if he looked away, the dwarves would just like kind of become dead again. They were almost like puppets, basically.
It was like playing a PlayStation game and you've got those like, what are they called? NPCs?
Yeah, like NPCs,
Non-playable
characters.
Non-playable characters. So when you're interacting with them, they seem to be like, you know, part of the game. And then you stop interacting with them and they're just kind of like...
Exactly. Like, okay. You could punch them in the face and they'd be like, nice to meet you, fellow traveler. Nice to meet you, fellow traveler. Yeah, so that's what these dwarves were like. So Aule offered to kill them. And Eru Iluvatar said, no, stop, I'll adopt them. And in the Silmarillion, the quote says, or Iluvatar says, but when the time comes, I will awaken them, and they shall be to thee as children, and often strife shall arise between thin and mine, the children of my adoption and the children of my choice. So from that quote, it seems that the two races were destined to clash, and it explains why their ways and their desires were polar opposites. So if we look at everything that contrasts between the elves and the dwarves, for example, I said it earlier, elves are tall, slender and beardless. Dwarves are short, stout and hairy. Elves use bows and precision, while dwarves use axes and brute force. Elves live in the woods and trees and are surrounded by nature and bright light, while the dwarves live in underground, cold, dark halls, Finally, elves preserve and coexist with nature whilst dwarves manipulate the land and mine and build. Mm. So, like, everything about them, like, it's not like one is better than the other. Well, that's an argument for another time, but it's just that they were completely polar opposites, and Eru Iluvatar, he adopted them as his children, so they weren't his own. So I think there might even be that, like, grown
foster
jealousy kind of thing, you know, going on there. Like, the dwarves don't even know it themselves, but they're jealous of these beautiful creatures. So I don't know, there's a little bit of that you can look
at. That was nice though, Dave. Well done. I liked that.
Did you like that? Yeah.
Good job, yeah. I like just the way that you said that and the way you listed them there. So that was very good. Well done. Good man. However, I did have one kind of, not gripe, but you said that the elves were all about, you know, using bows and precision, whereas the dwarves were using axes. And obviously,
you're going to talk about the way that they mine things. And
no, I'm going to talk about the precision of Gimli when he smashes his axe on the One Ring. I always, whenever I watch that scene in the Council of Elrond, when he's got the One Ring is sitting there and Gimli's like, well, what are we waiting for? And then he like grabs his axe and he absolutely, you know, belts it. But like, I mean, that must be impossible to have a huge axe, swing it full force and be that precise and like hit the One Ring, because a ring is not a big target.
Do we really see what happens in that scene? First of all, he could miss the ring by at least a foot and we just don't see it. We just see
I think if he missed the ring and if he just hit that big, like, whatever that table thing it was on, he wouldn't have been thrown backwards by the power of the One Ring.
Maybe it was his own power, like, whacking that table, and naturally he would have fallen over. Also, he could have turned his axe so it wasn't the pointy part. He could have just slapped the ring. It doesn't take a lot of precision to do that.
Yeah, Gimli trying to chop down a tree, he's just whacking it with the flat side.
It's just pure brute force and no precision.
Yeah, he just rests the axe against the tree and just starts punching it.
Just headbutting it, yeah.
Like, Gimli, do you know how to use an axe at all?
Yeah, that's why they wear those big helmets, so they're just like whacking into the trees.
But I was always impressed with Gimli's accuracy and his precision in that moment in the film. Maybe that wasn't exactly the way it happened, and maybe in the real situation, the books, he had to actually swing at it like 7 or 8 times before he finally hit the ring.
How embarrassing!
And then Elrond was like, "Oh my god, I'm just going to let him keep going, and then he'll figure it out himself."
And how is it that his axe just smashes into pieces, like into pure smithereens? Like, is that because of the ring or was it axe?
Smithereens. Oh.
Aule, the smithereens. I think he's just got a really crap axe. Right, the power of the ring.
Maybe his
power of the ring compel you.
Maybe the axe is made out of like the same chocolate that's used for like an Easter egg or something. It just shattered into bits. Oh, that'd be yummy.
So lastly, I just wanted you, would you be able to remind our listeners what happened to Legolas and Gimli after the events of Lord of the Rings, or what did they do after the events?
They got married.
Aragorn made it legal and dwarves and elves married each other.
Yeah. It's a beautiful ceremony. So they obviously, you know, they were known for their great friendship, and they went on a lot of trips together, and they visited different areas. They visited mountains, and they went and visited each other's homes. And Gimli was like, "Welcome down. This is where I grew up, and this is where I was when I was a wee lad.
This is my mom."
Exactly. And Legolas did the same, brought him around. And then eventually they sailed away together to the west and into the Undying Lands. And Gimli was actually allowed passage as the only dwarf to be allowed into the Undying Lands because of his great friendship with Legolas. And so they were just the two best buds
that ever were. Yeah, exactly. You're right. And with all that said, it really emphasizes the importance and strength of Legolas and Gimli's relationship. And we can appreciate it much more when we realize that the races of elves and dwarves didn't just dislike each other due to petty grievances, no pun intended with petty, but were inherently destined to be rivals and had thousands of years of strife between one another. And perhaps this was the catalyst for change with the animosity between elves and dwarves, with Gimli and Legolas having their civil ceremony and sailing off to the Undying Lands on their honeymoon. But in my opinion, overcoming this and their own differences truly cements Legolas and Gimli as one of the greatest friendships of all time.
Ah, it's lovely.
But then again, there's people that are going to say, Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin.
Or the Melonheads.
Or the Melonheads, yeah, that's true.
When are we going to sail off together? Into the West.
Yeah, I don't know. We're already living in the West.
Well, you are.
So. Oh, that's true, yeah.
But we'll voyage out west, out to the Arid Islands.
So do you feel like you've become more smarter, better? More better, smarter?
Much more smartest than I was before. Yeah. Yeah, as I said, a lot of this information, I think I'm just really tired as well right now. So I'm kind of not on the ball today in terms of remembering details very, very well. But yeah, that was good. There was things that you reminded me of a lot there. And there was other things that I had just completely forgotten. Like the whole story of like Thingol and all that stuff. That was cool. I enjoyed it.
And yeah.
Yeah. I promise I'll never forget again. I definitely will.
100%. So that's all this week on the Council of Elrond, and I hope you guys have enjoyed this latest episode and learned something new. First of all, do you agree with me about Legolas and Gimli's friendship being the best, or can you think of a better Tolkien friendship, or even another friendship in general? Maybe something else like, well, we discussed maybe the Melonheads, or Woody and Buzz, or Han and Chewie. So please get in touch on our social medias, which are listed in the podcast info section. Also, let us know what you're thinking of season 2 of the Council of Elrond, because this is really fun and exciting for us. And don't forget to give us a rating, and leaving a review would also be very helpful. So thank you.
Like that and
would
subscribe.
Help massively. Like and subscribe and click here and there and everywhere. And also, thank you to everyone who's joined us on Patreon recently. And a special thank you to Jack Knightley, who has joined our Ranger of the Dunedain level tier. So thank you very much for that. But yeah, thank you all so much, and we will see you and talk to you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.